We are now joined on the phone by Christina Dunbar Hester, who teaches journalism and media studies in the School of Communications and Information at Rutgers University, where she's also affiliated in the faculty in the Women's and Gender Studies Department, and previously worked at Prometheus Radio Project at some point, and has a new book out called Low Power to the People, Pirates, Protest, and Politics in FM Radio Activism. Christina Dunbar Hester, welcome to the Saturday Afternoon Show.
Thank you. Hi, Tom. Thanks.
I lost myself there. Where are you calling from today?
I am actually in New York City. I live here and commute out to New Jersey. So, greetings from the Lower East Side.
And the book is out already, or is it coming out? Or
it came out earlier this month. Yeah, so it's available now.
And how long have you been working on studying up about low power FM?
Oh my, depends on where you draw the line, I guess. But this project began when I was a graduate student, actually up in Ithaca, New York.
Oops, did we lose? We lost her. Up. Oh, let's get her back here. You're listening to the Saturday Afternoon Show, and we had a Skype. There she is. Okay. We lost you for a second, Christina. I think we have you back now. Yes? Hello?
Yeah. Sorry about that. I have no idea what happened.
Just went out. Okay. So you were just introducing us to the book Low Power to the People, Pirates, Protest, and Politics in FM Radio Activism.
Yes. Hi. Wave signals not cooperating. Yeah. So I started this project when I was a graduate student, and I was interested in some general issues about the politics of technology in communication, and especially activist claims that access to communication and media technology constituted a broad platform for social justice and for democracy. And this was in the early 2000s. And what should be familiar is, you know, the wave of rhetoric about how the internet in particular was this very democratic and democratizing technology. And so I was in school and thinking, you know, that was all very interesting. But when I heard about people who were very technologically and digitally savvy and knew about the internet and internet-based technology, but were advocating for radio instead, for FM radio, I thought that that would constitute a really interesting place to, you know, do some research and, you know, listen to what I might find there. And so at that point, I went and was in Philadelphia through connections to people who'd been doing activism around indie media, and made contact with both Prometheus, the organization, and more local groups doing independent media and radio tinkering, electronics tinkering workshops. And so I started hanging out with them some in 2003. And then the period that the book follows, well, it's sort of roughly the decade 1996 to 2006. So starting with the Telecom Act, which of course allowed unprecedented media consolidation and was very, very stark for radio, where, you know, in a period of 5 years, Clear Channel bought up 1,200 radio stations. And so consolidation was really dramatic with radio.
You're talking about the 1996 Telecommunications Act?
Exactly. And so that's kind of one of the other, it happens before the period in my book, but it's looming large for the folks who were advocating for LPFM and then building LPFM.
Yeah. Why did you pick 2000 as sort of the turning point or something? Because you could easily, one could say that there was all kinds of low power involved in, say, the WTO protests in 1999. And there's not a lot of, there's more mention of John McCain in your book than there is of Mbana Kantaka or Stephen Dunifer.
Is that true?
Well, at least according to the index.
Okay. No, the prehistory here starts, I mean, depends on where you want to define it. Radio hams in 1910, radio broadcasting in 1920, certainly embedded practices of appropriate technology, community media, pirate radio and small-scale broadcasting are all in the mix, as well as, you mentioned, indie media anti-globalization stuff in the late 90s.
And we're leaving out the video freaks in the early 70s, too, I would mention, too.
We would also mention them, yes, and interesting work on that. Yes, absolutely. So that's another sort of moment of this, both accessibility of the technology, and, you know, more people are having access to it. You've got cable access and video collectives, and the radio. I tell the radio story more, but there are people working on the video story, and that's really important as well. Right. So I don't know if you want me to talk about the micro radio.
Well, my question, I guess, I brought up a lot of other things, but my question mainly was, why did you pick the year 2000 as sort of the turning point movement to start the book off, kind of?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, 2000 is when LPFM starts as a legal designation, but of course that doesn't make any sense, and what, you know, why people were pushing for it, why they were successful in their advocacy, you need the prehistory. So I think the book roughly covers, as I said, about 96 to 2006. The moment that LPFM is born legally is 2000. So that policy moment is really important. But of course, the period 1978 through 2000, when there's no legal access to this small scale broadcasting, and people are doing, like Denifer, like Kentaco, are doing the micro broadcasting and explicitly, you know, civil disobedience and flouting the FCC. That's really important too. But I think the pushback to the 96 Act is a big part of why the FCC began to reconsider their stance. So the early 2000s is when, you know, all of a sudden there's a new possibility for gaining legal access to a little slice of spectrum.
I can remember after the Telecommunications Act, the folks at Prometheus telling a story that commercial stations were calling them, asking how to become pirates because the economics had changed in such a way that you couldn't, you were getting bought up everywhere, and you couldn't run a mom-and-pop kind of radio station anymore.
Yeah, and a similar thing actually happened in the 1940s, too, right after the first major Telecommunications Act that actually brings the radio spectrum under the control of the FCC. And, you know, the period 1927 to 34 is when it was the Federal Radio Commission, then it's the Federal Communication Commission, is born. And I think in 1940, approximately 60% of the stations were networked. And by the end of the 1940s, it's something like 97%, because it's, yeah, the economic model is sort of, if you don't join a network, you kind of die during that period as well.
Did LPFM, I mean, it came into existence in 2000 after this long congressional battle where you had allies on both sides of the aisle, and then people who were getting money from the broadcast industry on both sides of the aisle opposing and making the argument that the tiny little stations were going to interfere with the big giant stations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when the FCC introduced LPFM, which was in, if I'm not mistaken, January 2000, there was immediate outcry from basically the telecom commercial broadcasters lobby, the National Association of Broadcasters, and also National Public Radio, perhaps curiously. And they cried foul, and that interference was going to run rampant and, you know, ruin listeners' experiences of their stations. And they went and appealed to members of Congress, you're absolutely right, on both sides of the aisle, and did stuff like distribute CDs containing sound effects with
made up
sound effects, right, with awful like screeching noises and static and interference, and, you know, said that this is what's going to happen on the airwaves if you let LPFMs onto the air.
Again, tiny little stations, 100 watts or less, against 50,000 watt stations or 10,000 watt stations.
Exactly. So they're teeny tiny. And so the FCC then was actually somewhat horrified and said this isn't true, but the issue was sort of gaining some traction in Congress. And I think that while this was motivated, I think, by fear of economic competition, you know, if you hand out those CDs, some people are going to be compelled by that because they don't understand the technical issues.
And it, well, actually killed the first round of LPFM. I mean, not killed, it lessened, excuse me. They put a wording in the bill that not as many stations were going to be allowed on the dial because they wanted to have this Defense Department test of this so-called interference problem, right?
Exactly. They wound up then introducing a more conservative spacing requirement that had that forced these, you're right, new tiny stations had to be even farther away on the dial from any incumbent broadcasters. And so naturally that limited the number of spaces you could fit these stations in and meant that they were only going to be, the licenses were probably only going to be effectively available in rural areas and small towns. And so, there's an arcane, this may be of interest to the listeners, an arcane history of what happened with the how this legislation got passed, because it actually didn't pass the Senate and it probably would have died, but it got snuck into an appropriations rider. So from December 2000 onward, this sort of little arcane part of the legislative process, but one we all recognize from the present day as well.
And it was because, what's his name, Dingell, and was it stopped? No, he was in the House. Who was the, there was a couple senators or that were stopping it. They were putting it in a pocket veto or something, or what is it called? Not a pocket veto,
Oh, gosh, I would have to look this
up. Yeah, we're getting way inside baseball now.
But exactly. McCain was one of the people who spoke out about that process. You can say whatever else you will about him, but he...
And when the LPFM movement actually had a lot of support from the Republican side or from the religious right, for instance, there's a lot of religious stations that have supported the idea of LPFM, where, as you said before, NPR was very much against it.
Yeah, because if you think about especially who's organized as constituents and community groups in rural areas, that's actually going to be a lot of evangelical churches. So LPFM really pricked up their ears and got their attention as something that they could use in their communities and in their congregations. And so on the right, there's also kind of a big guy, little guy split where the commercial broadcast lobby, the NAB, was siding heavily with large syndicated religious broadcasters, and then you've got the little guys who wind up making strange bedfellows for left-wing activists like Prometheus and more left-center consumer advocacy groups, and they're all sort of working together to pull LPFM into being. And then, as we were talking about after 2000, when it gets limited, to actually undo the legislation that caused it to be so limited. And that legislative fight took fully 10 years. And so you mentioned a study getting commissioned, which it was. Congress commissioned an independent engineering study conducted by the MITRE Corporation. And that came out in 2003, and that confirmed the findings of the FCC in every way. And they actually didn't even complete all the tests because they said this is so ludicrous.
The third part was to study the cost of the interference, and they got to that and they said we can't do anything because we haven't found any interference.
Right, right. And so that happened, and so right around the time I started, you know, having meetings with Prometheus, they were kind of on tenterhooks waiting for that to come out. And then it came out and it supported everything that they were saying. And nonetheless, it still took another 7 years of fighting in Congress and pushing by allies and advocates to get the legislation passed, which happened in 2010, 2011. And so now LPFM is going to open back up. There's been a new window for licenses that was open in 2013, and new stations can start being built once again.
Yeah, now Hudson Valley, there are I think 7 or 8 different stations that won construction permits and are working in some level to get on the air as soon as possible. And how many are there around the country? Do you know?
I've seen varying accounts. I don't know how many construction permits have been issued. But I think 1,000 would be on the conservative side, and it might be up to a couple thousand, something like that.
And what do you think the impact has been? You talk in the book about how community advocates don't like to cite arbitrary numbers. It's not just about listeners, raw numbers of listeners, but how listeners to LPFM stations are much more engaged.
Yeah, I think that one of the points that advocates make that I agree with is it would be a mistake to adopt metrics that are designed to think about market share to consider the impact of these stations or the value of these stations. Because they are tiny, they're 100 watts, and they reach, you know, a few miles from the site of transmission. And so in absolute numbers, even having a few thousand on the air, the listenership is not going to be as big as, you know, probably the single largest commercial station in the country. It might, you know, that one station might be have a bigger audience. But I don't think that that's necessarily the way we want to consider this, or certainly not where we would want to leave it. One of the, I think, most important things about these stations is that they symbolically and materially provide a space for people to get on the air, people to speak, people to listen, and media to function really, really differently than it does when it's a consolidated, huge conglomerate where ordinary people will not have the right or the ability to speak or to be members of the public sphere in the same way they can with community media. And so I think even in forcing that space for community members on the dial, it sort of symbolically leaves open the possibility for imagining citizens to participate in public deliberation and culture in a way that's foreclosed without those spaces. And so I think that that's actually a really powerful symbolic value, whether or not, you know, the audienceship is huge.
Can you tell, I'm guessing that the LPFMs are most effective in like a small town or a neighborhood in a big city where it's a geographic or community that's already existing and it can reach the entire community.
Yeah, I think that these stations, it's a little bit hard to generalize because they are, you know, community governance at its finest. And so how they appeal to members of the community and who is on them and how they use their airtime varies a lot. But in theory, there is, you know, some level of, or a pretty strong level of tie to the community and often a mission of public service in the community. And so that can manifest in a variety of ways, including, you know, openness to all kinds of programmers, including commitment to, you know, carrying political or municipal conversations that, again, wouldn't have a lot of market value, really, if you're talking about the public affairs of a small town or a neighborhood. But, you know, they create a space where they're interested in covering those affairs, and then people want to listen or call in or speak to those issues. And so, you know, in a sort of general sense, that's something people use them for. But specifically, it can vary quite widely, whether it's, you know, musical programming or talk or, again, religious programming or, you know, all kinds of things. And the neat thing, actually, is each station is deciding how they're doing that by themselves. So you're going to get a hugely heterogeneous, I think, swath of the public and of use of the airwaves.
And are the original opponents of LPFM, are they still as enthusiastically against the service, or has NPR and the National Association of Broadcasters chilled out a little bit about it?
I'm pretty sure that NPR is officially and publicly more thumbs up. And I also think that given the way the politicking and lobbying works, unfortunately, if they had still been as vociferously opposed, advocates might still be pushing for that legislation. So I was hearing, and again, who knows how reliable this is, but people tracking the issue, you know, the insider baseball stuff, by the second half of the 2000s that the most vocal opponents had calmed down some. I haven't seen anything where the NAB has officially welcomed 1,000 new LPFMs onto the airwaves. I don't think that that happened. And then NPR, I think, was a somewhat more complicated story, too, where the top brass had been more opposed. But I think that some of the reporters and people who did programming, because they valued radio and because they valued, you know, the diversity of what radio could do, even from the get-go, a lot of them probably got what LPFM had to offer.
Yeah, while the guys in the suits in the offices were against it, NPR actually did a lot of reporting on the issue that was kind of vital at the time to push other mainstream media to report on the issue also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as we know, once the media thinks you're important, that's how you're important. So.
Is this kind of breadcrumbs and circuses to some extent, that this very old media that is kind of being abandoned to some extent for newer, sexier transmissions is given, people are given access to their own airwaves there, but not in other places?
Well, I think it's really complicated. And, you know, various advocates for LPFM made the point over the years that if nobody cared about the spectrum, they would have walked away from it. And they didn't, they being the incumbents. And I don't think that it's economically terribly less valuable in 2014 than it was in 2000. And in fact, I mean, this kind of goes up and down. But even in looking at the most recent statistics I could find before the publication of the book, revenue on, which again, here's the market metrics, but they do tell us something. Advertising revenue on commercial radio had fallen a little bit, but then rose again during the period of economic recession. The absolute number of FM radio stations has increased. So it's certainly not this teleological story where the sun is setting on radio and rising on internet-based technologies. Like, the data is just not there for that. That said, when I talk to my students about radio, I teach undergraduates, they are, you know, younger people, and they're not always as familiar with the diversity of what radio can be, which I think makes sense. You know, they were, I don't know, 11 in 1996 or something like that. So maybe even younger. They, you know, aren't always convinced about radio, but then actually if we talk through LPFM and community radio is a great metaphor in addition to a great, you know, technology. People kind of get it. Oh, that's a platform for speaking to my community. You know, that's a platform for engaging in my community. So again, the symbolic role, I think, of having citizen access to this public resource, to this telecommunication resource, is a really great story.
But
regardless of the technical change,
has anybody done a study to say, like, are people more likely to vote if they live in an area where there's a community radio station? Has there been anything of that sort, you know, to sort of engage the level of engagement with the listeners?
I don't actually know. The best thing I can think of, I would know a couple people to ask, but offhand, I don't know the answer to that. But people also do show that people who are well connected on one medium are also likely to be connected on others. So it's not actually people only use things selectively and in isolation. And if you're kind of thickly networked and engaged in your community affairs, I would guess, again, these are not sort of isolated stories. I would guess that if you're active on, you know, a social media website about community affairs, you would also be interested in an LPFM in your station. And people who are engaged in all of those things are really likely to be engaged in civic campaigns and voting. That would be my suspicion. But I'd have to look up citations for you otherwise.
I guess one final question. Is there anything that most surprised you in doing the research for this book?
Well, most surprised me. One thing that's actually surprising to me a bit right now, perhaps, is I think when I was doing this research, people thought I was really weird, not necessarily the activists, but a lot of academics. You know, the activists already knew what they were doing was important, but a lot of academics, it became this very novelty-seeking, forward-facing moment where everything was new media and digital media. And, you know, what's the next big thing? Oh, now we need big data. Oh, now we need social networks. And so I think, honestly, I was regarded as someone having done something strange and anachronistic and of little relevance for a few years. And I think that started to change. And that kind of surprises me, but it leaves me kind of hopeful. I think that there's some of the internet hype has maybe crested and broken open a little bit. So I think there's more of a room for a wider conversation right now. And people are starting to remember also the kind of lessons of history as we're having debates about net neutrality, for example, right now. People are, even again, students, the sharp ones will kind of get it and say, oh, we actually have pretty similar, you know, corporate legislative institutional players on the one hand, and then similar issues about what's in the public interest on the other hand. And so if we forget the lessons from the history and present of radio, that leaves us much more poorly equipped to think about the challenges facing us in terms of a wider, you know, conversation about media policy, technology, you know, rights and democracy. And as I said, I've been a little bit pleasantly surprised that I think people are actually kind of opening up their ears again about this being a wider field of technological possibility and political possibility than just internet or digital media. That's a long-winded answer, but that's
right.
What I would say.
We're speaking with Christina Dunbar-Hester, who has a new book called Low Power to the People, Pirates, Protest, and Politics in FM Radio Activism. Christina, do you want to give out any sort of websites or information where people can get the book? Or?
Sure. You can, if you're interested in looking at the book, you can look on the MIT Press website. If you just Google Low Power to the People, MIT. If you're interested in looking at some of the advocacy around low-power radio, you can look at PrometheusRadio.org, which is the organization that was the sort of kernel of my research. And they're actually also selling the book, so if you want to support them and not Amazon, you could go to their site. That'll probably do it.
All right. And thank you so much for talking to us today about your new book, Low Power to the People, Pirates, Protest, and Politics in FM Radio Activism, out on MIT Press, all about the low power FM movement and recent legislation, and now thousands of stations around the country going on the air.
Thank you so much, Tom. And thank you to the listeners as well. Thanks.
All right.